Today is Wednesday, July 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Congress looks for answers as the White House defends the president on a report of Russian bounties on U.S. troops.
There's no consensus. It was not credible. But make no mistake, this president will always protect American troops.
The top U.S. infectious disease physician tells Congress if we continue on the same track, COVID-19 could get a lot worse.
I think it's important to tell you and the American public that I'm very concerned because it could get very bad.
Also ahead, a beloved American comedy writer known for his iconic sitcoms has died. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is coming under growing pressure to respond to allegations that Russia offered bounties for killing American troops in Afghanistan. News media reports that Trump was briefed on the matter continued to roil Washington on Tuesday. U.S. lawmakers are pushing for answers after the White House said the president was not aware of the intelligence because it hadn't been verified. Joining us for an update on the briefings, VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, was it the usual partisanship, or were there Democrats and Republicans actually both looking to get to the bottom of this?
So there was a little bit of further clarity for lawmakers Tuesday as some groups of them shuttled over to the White House to receive a briefing from Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and other intel personnel so that they could learn a little bit more about what was going on with these Russian bounties on U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Now, part of the confusion is that there are select groups of lawmakers that are going over to the White House. First, there was a group of congressional Republicans, and then Tuesday morning, a group of congressional Democrats went over. As is usual, each side saw that intelligence briefing in very different terms. The Democrats were quite concerned by what was going on. They said that nothing in that briefing led them to believe that this was a hoax or that the intelligence material was unverified. We heard from House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff in particular, who knows how these intelligence products work. And he said, look, there are different levels of verification within the intelligence community. And something, a security threat of this level, concern, almost certainly would have been brought to the president's attention, even if it wasn't 100% verified.
I do not understand for a moment why the president isn't saying this to the American people right now and is relying on, I don't know, I haven't heard, I haven't been briefed. That's just not excusable.
On the other side, congressional Republicans were saying that they didn't see anything that really corroborated what was in that initial New York Times report. So while there was concern from both sides, there was definitely a divide on whether or not the president should have been briefed on this.
So when this first came out, the White House said that the president had not been briefed. Things that are not verifiable aren't necessarily presented to the president. What is the White House saying now about it? Has their explanation expanded or changed in any way?
We certainly heard again from the White House press secretary that this intelligence had never been verified, that it hadn't been necessary to take it to the level of the president and the vice president. But she also kind of took a new approach on Tuesday, saying that the New York Times report had endangered national security because clearly this was a leak from within the intelligence community.
These are rogue intelligence officers who are imperiling our troops' lives. We will not be able to get, very likely not be able to get a consensus on this intelligence because of what was leaked to the New York Times.
Of course, that also begs the question, if it was a dangerous leak from within the intelligence community, if it wasn't verifiable, how do those two explanations match up? She said that the New York Times should not be leaking this type of information and that, you know, this was something that would have to be played out now in the public sphere, which is really where intelligence products should not be discussed.
How do they leave it? Are they planning to have more meetings on this, or is the president planning on making any kind of statement?
So remember that because these select groups of Republicans and Democrats have been shuttling back and forth from Capitol Hill to the White House to receive these select briefings, that means that some of the top congressional leadership, including Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, have actually not yet been briefed on this. And they're part of that so-called gang of eight, kind of that top congressional leadership and the heads of the Senate and House Intelligence committees. They're reportedly going to be headed to the White House within the next day or so to receive that briefing, and we would expect to hear more from that come out as they come back to Capitol Hill and digest that knowledge that they received.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Well, now for further analysis, we are joined by Jamil Jaffer, founder and CEO of the National Security Institute in Washington. Thank you for being with us. So wouldn't something as serious as this, whether 100% verified or not, by intelligence warrant notifying the president of the United States?
What the latest reports seem to indicate that in fact, the president was given written materials, at least on one, if not two occasions, that described the situation of Russian bounties. Now, there is some reporting that we saw yesterday that suggested at least one intelligence agency dissented and that there was some disagreement and that the reporting may have been viewed as not credible enough to make it to the president's desk. So there is contrary reporting out there on this question about what exactly the president knew and when. But of course, the fundamental problem here is that the story keeps changing. We haven't yet gotten one consistent story from the White House and from the DNI and the former DNI and the rest of the intelligence community agencies about what exactly, who was told what when. And it feels like on an issue like this, it should be pretty easy to figure out. Even if it's fragmentary reporting, and even if it wasn't particularly well-sourced, even if there were dissents, this is the kind of explosive reporting that people were definitely paying attention to. And it shouldn't be hard to figure out who was told what, when, and the fact that we aren't getting a straight story on that suggests there's at least some significant confusion, which is concerning enough, or outright untruths being told about who knew what, when. And so that's what we gotta figure out. Congress is obviously pretty spun up about this, Democrats and Republicans alike. You've seen a number of Republican members of the House, including Liz Cheney, Dan Crenshaw, Adam Kinzinger, others who have made it clear that they want to know what was going on, what the president knew, and when. Either way, regardless of whether when he figured it out, now that he knows and now that everybody knows what exactly is being done about to protect American soldiers and to punish Russia for this behavior and stop them from doing it again.
Even if the president didn't know about it, he definitely knows now. And should he be coming out and saying something to the American people about being very serious about looking at this and taking action if needed?
Of course, the president should be out there being very aggressive about this. He should be looking into it already himself with his team. They should be figuring out whether this is accurate reporting or not. And if it is, they should be taking action. They should immediately be calling Russia to account. The ambassador should have already been at the White House being called on the carpet. The president should have already made a phone call to Vladimir Putin, making it clear that he will not accept this behavior. Unfortunately, the president's done the opposite of all those things. Right? The president has, in fact, suggested that the New York Times report is inaccurate, that there is not, that the source doesn't exist, that this is all fake news, this is a hoax. And so if this were just one event standing alone, it would be concerning enough. But of course, it's in the larger context of the president's sort of ignoring of the intelligence community when it came to the Russians' influence on the 2016 elections and his belief that Vladimir Putin was telling him the truth and Russia when he said he wasn't involved, which we now know is demonstrably false and incorrect. The Russians very clearly were seeking to influence the 2016 elections, at least influence Americans' perceptions of our rule of law institutions and the like, and continue to do so to this day. And so this is all very concerning. And at the end of the day, this goes to the larger question of the president's views on national security and views on American enemies like Russia and what he's going to do about it if, in fact, this does turn out to be true.
Jamil Jaffer, founder and CEO of the National Security Institute in Washington. The United States saw a 46% increase in new cases of COVID-19 at the end of last week. The nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, testifying at a Senate hearing on Tuesday on reopening schools and workplaces, said this could get very dangerous in the U.S. if Americans don't start following public health recommendations.
We are now having 40-plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around.
And asked what we can expect following recent surges in many states,
I can't make an accurate prediction, but it is going to be very disturbing. I will guarantee you that, because when you have an outbreak in one part of the country, even though in other parts of the country they're doing well, they are vulnerable.
Fauci said areas seeing recent outbreaks are putting the entire nation at risk, including areas that have made progress in reducing coronavirus cases. He cited recent video footage of people socializing in crowds, often without masks and otherwise ignoring safety guidelines. China's parliament passed national security legislation for Hong Kong on Tuesday, setting the stage for the most radical changes to the former British colony's way of life since it returned to Chinese rule 23 years ago. The law comes in response to last year's often violent pro-democracy protests and will allow authorities to crack down on subversive and secessionist activity in Hong Kong. Hong Kong's sole representative on the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress confirmed the law had been passed. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to reporter Ria Mogul in Hong Kong via WhatsApp.
So we actually know absolutely nothing about what the law actually says. In fact, this morning there was a press conference where the chief executive, Carrie Lam, was asked what she knew about the law and whether she knew if the law had actually been passed. And she was unable to provide a single detail because she doesn't know.
Leading up to the vote, there was some discussion in Hong Kong, and Carrie Lam said that she had not viewed the legislation yet. Is that still what we believe to be true?
Yeah, so very few people, I believe just an absolute handful of people, had actually seen the law. And I don't think it was the whole law in its entirety. It was just little bits of it. You know, the only people that have seen it are the top officials in Beijing. So hardly anyone has really seen this law. And, you know, a lot of critics, a lot of human rights lawyers, a lot of activists are very outspoken and angry about this and critical about what this law will entail. You know, if we go by how the mainland treats voices of opposition, the outcome will be very bleak for a lot of activists in Hong Kong. And bear in mind, you know, last year's anti-extradition protests and pro-democracy protests has resulted in thousands of protesters behind bars. And what this means for them is to be seen.
What's been the reaction in Hong Kong after the announcement?
As expected, this law is having a very chilling effect in Hong Kong. You know, within an hour of the law being passed, Joshua Wong, Hong Kong's, you know, the face of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement, announced on Twitter that he was going to step down from his political party. And following his announcement, three other members of his political party, which is called Democisto, three other members stepped down as well. And later in the day, Democisto announced that they had disbanded completely. You know, thousands of activists have deleted their social media presence. Activists are requesting media outlets to take down opinion pieces that are critical of China's government. You know, so everyone is very, very scared. Everyone's quite terrified and just sad. Everyone's, you know, just heartbroken at the events that have transpired today. That being said, a few pro-democracy activists have still said that tomorrow, so on Wednesday, which is the anniversary of the handover from, you know, Britain to Chinese rule in 1997, they said that they will still go ahead and, you know, march for democracy in Hong Kong.
Reporter Ria Mogul in Hong Kong speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Arab states are warning Israel that its plans to annex the West Bank will trigger violence and regional instability. Unilateral annexation could happen as early as this week, but European states, the United Nations, the Arab League, and senior members of the U.S. Democratic Party say the move will harm chances for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, Jordan.
Jordan is only one of two Arab countries, along with Egypt, to have signed peace treaties with Israel, and it supports the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. The kingdom has made clear to Israel that it risks a harsh response to even a limited annexation of West Bank land. It has threatened to annul or downgrade its 1994 peace treaty with Israel if the annexation goes ahead. King Abdullah II made his concerns about the possible ramifications known to European leaders and Washington, where he is well respected as a key U.S. ally in the region. Jordanian analyst Osama El-Sharif tells VOA that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan is very divisive, not only among Israel society and security communities, but also within the U.S. administration and elsewhere.
It's a can of worms, and people wonder why Netanyahu would have taken such a controversial step when Israel remains an occupation force in control of the West Bank, the Jordan Valley, the borders, anything that goes in and out of the occupied territories. And it still was being treated as a normal state by the Europeans and by the rest of the world. So why take that risk of putting Israel against possible sanctions, especially from the European countries, being in violation of the Geneva Accords and of the international resolution?
El-Sharif warns that even an initial limited annexation of one or two Jewish settlements on the West Bank will jeopardize warming ties between Israel and Gulf Arab powerhouses, United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
The Gulf position normalization was going on behind closed doors progressively, and now they are in a jam, a deadlock. They cannot condone annexation and continue normalization with Israel.
But Middle East analyst Theodore Karasik at Gulf State Analytics tells VOA that despite public condemnation by the UAE or Saudi Arabia of Israel's annexation plans, these Arab states in the Gulf will likely want to maintain ties with Israel.
Iran is one of the key motivators of this policy because the thinking is the UAE, Saudi, Israel are more formidable together against Iran. The long-term threat from Iranian ballistic and cruise missiles plus a nuclear program makes them nervous.
These countries share growing concerns over Iran's mounting military activities in the region. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Sahel countries and their ally France on Tuesday vowed to press ahead with a tactical shift in their campaign against an eight-year-old jihadist insurgency, saying the change had notched up substantial gains, although major challenges still remain. We hear more now from Nicolas Pinault in Paris.
The one-day summit gathered the presidents of Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania and Niger, as well as France. The heads of state met in the Mauritanian capital, Nouakchott, to review their new strategy at the six-month mark. French President Emmanuel Macron said there had been spectacular results. We are convinced that victory is possible in the Sahel and that this is decisive for stability in Africa and Europe, he said. Under the change, France deployed an extra 500 troops to its Barkhane anti-jihad force in the Sahel, bringing its complement to 5,100. Since then, the jihadists have continued to carry out attacks almost daily, but they also lost a key leader to a French raid and are fighting internally, according to security forces. Coalition forces have focused on the three border region, a hotspot of jihadism where the frontiers of Burkina, Niger and Mali converge. Areas have been taken back from the terrorist groups and the armies are redeployed, claimed Macron, adding that the tactics have shifted the dynamic. President Mohamed Ould Cheikh Al-Ghazouani of Mauritania was earlier more cautious, saying there had been significant progress, but this wasn't sufficient in the face of the mounting challenges that they have to meet. A violent extremism in all its forms continued to hit several zones and is expanding in a worrying manner, he said. The next summit of the Sahel allies was set for early 2021. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
The European Union's most powerful member, Germany, takes over the bloc's rotating presidency next month amid a raft of challenges from COVID-19 and the economic devastation that it's wrought to Brexit, to trade with China, and tensions with the United States. Lisa Bryant has more on the stakes from Paris.
Germany's presidency comes as its leader, Angela Merkel, the European Union's longer-serving current head of state, is expected to leave office next year. Both she and the bloc have plenty on their plates. On the EU's immediate agenda is overcoming differences to push through an $843 billion coronavirus recovery fund aimed to boost a green economic reboot. Then there's getting agreement on the EU's next multi-year budget with a proposed price tag of more than $1 trillion.
Die Erwartungen sind hoch
Meeting Monday with France's President Emmanuel Macron in Messenburg, Germany, Merkel said she hoped the 27-member bloc would strike a deal on both at a July summit. The German presidency comes as Merkel is riding a crest of popularity, partly over her handling of the coronavirus outbreak. While Germany often sides with more frugal bloc members who are reluctant to offer large, non-repayable grants, Merkel teamed up with Macron to push for a massive coronavirus recovery package. The EU and Britain have also intensified negotiations aimed to define their post-Brexit relationship, with London eager to wrap things up speedily. John Springford is deputy director of the London-based Center for European Reform Research Institute.
There's a realization that she wants to have been a chancellor that has made Europe stronger. And so there was a kind of happy marriage of interests going on between her and Macron.
Sébastien Maillard, head of the Paris-based Jacques Delors Institute think tank, agrees Merkel is thinking about her legacy.
It's really a time for her to make history. So this presidency, yes, will surely make a difference compared to previous ones.
But making a difference doesn't promise to be easy. Reuters reports Germany wants more reciprocity with China following complaints by European companies of an uneven playing field when it comes to market access. Tensions between the EU and the United States have also grown under the Trump administration, which plans to withdraw thousands of U.S. troops from Germany.
I think a strong desire to have some strong relationship, because we know that we share many common values and that there is much for both economies to share together, but to really be treated on even terms, and for the US to consider the EU as a whole, not try to divide it.
But analysts like Daniel Gross are skeptical about just how far Germany can go as European Council president. Gross directs the Center for European Policy Studies in Brussels.
The presidency, especially if a big country, cannot achieve a lot. Because if a big country tries to push its own priorities, the others usually react allergically.
What's clear is there is plenty of work ahead for Berlin and for Brussels in the months ahead. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Here are some of the other stories we're following from around the world. Despite a renewed focus on wrongful arrests and racial discrimination after the death of George Floyd, politicians and activists in the U.S. say meaningful reform of the massive criminal justice system in America is unlikely to happen ahead of the November election. Congress has been unable to reach a bipartisan agreement on how to respond to demands for change in recent weeks, making it unlikely in the months to come. The nationwide Black Lives Matter protests are also unlikely to end anytime soon. And Vladimir Putin Tuesday urged Russians to vote for constitutional changes that would allow him to run again for president twice, saying the reforms would guarantee stability, security, and prosperity. Putin made his appeal at the scene of a bloody World War II battle between the Russian Red Army and the Nazis on the eve of the main nationwide vote that could change the constitution for the first time since 1993. You're listening to International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues this week in the DRC as millions of Congolese celebrate the 60th anniversary of independence from Belgium. They'll also be celebrating the fall of one of the most prominent symbols of the colonization and plunder of their country, King Leopold II. Inspired by the U.S. Black Lives Matter movement, protesters in Belgian cities have taken down several statues depicting the former leader. King Leopold II, who's been called the Butcher of the Congo, oversaw a brutal administration over the Congo Free State, responsible for the deaths of an estimated 10 million Congolese in a span of 23 years. Professor Adam Hochschild, author of the critically acclaimed book King Leopold's Ghost, tells VOA's Jackson Vunganyi that Leopold, who never stepped foot in Congo, ruled the country like it was his personal property.
The Belgian government was not interested in colonies because they thought that was an extravagance for a small country with no navy and no merchant marine. But for Leopold, that was not a problem. He thought, well, I'll get my own personal colony. So he hired the explorer Henry Morton Stanley to stake it out for him. And by 1885, he'd gotten first the United States and then all the major nations of the world to recognize the Congo, the same territory roughly as the boundaries of the Democratic Republic of Congo today, as belonging to him personally.
Not the country of Belgium or the kingdom of Belgium, but for him as a king, personally, it was his personal.
It was his personal possession, and he talked about himself as its proprietor. And it was more than 70 times the size of Belgium. It remained in his personal possession for 23 years. And then in 1908, a year before he died, it became the Belgian Congo. But up to that point, it belonged to him personally, and he made an enormous fortune from it during that time, chiefly by developing a forced labor system to gather what was then the territory's most lucrative commodity, which was wild rubber. And basically, his soldiers would go into village after village, would hold the women hostage in order to force the men of each village to go deep into the rainforest for days and eventually weeks out of each month and gather a monthly quota of wild rubber. And you can actually see photographs of these women hostages in chains.
What was happening in the world at the time? What was driving the need for this rubber?
Good question. It really began in 1887 when for the first time they invented the inflatable bicycle tire. And then suddenly there was a big demand for rubber for bicycle tires, and very soon after that for automobiles, which really began in the 1890s. There was also a big market for rubber in industrial uses of all kinds, belts, rubber belts in factories, rubber coatings on the telegraph and telephone wires, which were spreading all over the world.
What are some of the ghosts that are still haunting, Leopold's ghosts that are still haunting the DRC now?
I would say the biggest ghost is this. The whole system of colonialism, under colonialism, government, as experienced by people in Africa, was basically an organized system of plunder. Government departments of every kind essentially existed to speed the theft of raw materials out of the country and get them to Europe. When the Congo became independent rather suddenly in 1960, there had been no experience whatever of self-government, you know, even allowing people to have local elections or anything like that. And I think the experience of government as an organized system of plunder continued. For 32 years, the fairly newly independent Congo was ruled by the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, who made a personal fortune even greater than that of Leopold's. He had a much more developed economy to plunder, and he also had strong support from the United States. He turned that country almost into a private colony of his own. After his downfall and death in 1997, the country has mainly been run by the Kabila dynasty, father and son, who've also amassed a considerable fortune, and who, even though the younger Kabila is now officially out of power, he has enormous influence behind the scenes. And I think the experience of government as an organized system of plunder has continued. And that's a very difficult heritage to get rid of.
Professor Adam Hochschild, author of the critically acclaimed book King Leopold's Ghost, speaking with VOA's Jackson Vunganyi. And Carl Reiner, the ingenious and versatile writer, actor, and director who rose to comedy's front ranks as creator of the iconic sitcom The Dick Van Dyke Show and straight man for Mel Brooks's 2,000-year-old man, as well as playing the role as an elderly con man in the revived Ocean's 11 series, has died. Carl Reiner, the ingenious and versatile writer, actor, and director who rose to comedy's front ranks as creator of the iconic The Dick Van Dyke Show, straight man to Mel Brooks's 2,000-year-old man, and the role as an elderly con man in the revived Ocean's 11 series, has died. Reiner's assistant said he died Monday night of natural causes at his home in Beverly Hills, California. Known as one of show business's best-liked men, the tall, bald Reiner was said to be a welcome face on the small and silver screens. Carl Reiner was 98. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening.